Yeah, let me, there we go. Okay.
Okay, who's ready?
All right.
You want to go first?
Go ahead.
So, we learned today that we often believe in lies from the past that hold us back to still be a victim and not to be whole and not to dwell in our real identity and find joy. But how come that we still believe these lies if it says in the Bible that we are dead for sin, so also for the lies of the devil? Where is this? Where's the problem that we still believe these lies even if everything is or should be in the grave, should not come out again when we get out of the grave?
Short question. Why do we still believe the lies?
You've got to repeat the question.
That's what I'm doing. That's what I'm trying to do. I'm putting it into my words so I can answer it, you know. So I can't answer any of them. I can respond to them. When I do a couples retreat, I'll ask, we have an optional session for people, and they can come and to it if they want to, but there's a price they pay to come, and the price is you have to ask a question, and you have to write it on a 3x5 card, and it has to be a legitimate question, and the session is about sexuality. I usually have good attendance, and people ask all these wild questions, and so I tell them, I said, you can't ask me a question I won't respond to. I don't know if I can answer it, but I can respond to every question you ask. Okay, so you're asking a question about if what God provides for us is life, godliness, goodness, mercy, grace plenty, grace that's sufficient. You don't have to ask for more. If that's true, why do we still get caught in the lie? Okay, and that is the rub. That's the issue. And I like to think about it this way. I don't know if I can draw it to my satisfaction, but I can try. Guilt is the issue. And that's why we need mercy. That's why we need grace. And so the cross takes away our guilt. In the middle of a story of David in Samuel, where it's 2 Samuel 12, I think it is, where you have the Bathsheba story. Nathan catches David. Now, this is important because I was talking this morning about how if you're a victim, you believe that your issues are outside of you. And that's how, you know, circumstances cause you to be a victim. Instead of managing your interior world, the only thing you really have any degree of control over at all. So in that story, David says, "You caught me," right? But he gets caught from the outside, which I think from a psychological point of view is profoundly important. If you catch yourself inside, your own conscience, if you're caught on the inside, it's a whole different ball game than being caught on the outside. So David was caught on the outside and he confessed. Thumbs up, good job. But not enough that you still have to wrestle with yourself in some way. So it's interesting that Nathan says, here are the consequences. You're forgiven, but here are the consequences. And by the way, David didn't ask for forgiveness. He just confessed. Isn't that fascinating? And then the text says this, Nathan says, oh, by the way, David, God has taken away your sin. By the way, I've never heard a sermon preached on that line. I think I know why, but here's what I think that means. It means that the guilt is gone. Okay, so the guilt part of the equation is gone, and what God gives you then is hope and life, but forgiveness doesn't remove consequences. The lie, as I understand it, what gets us in trouble with the lie is, it's more complicated than just, oh, that's a lie. We're blinded to it. Satan's tools are to blind you and deceive you. And so he can't change this truth. Okay? And so I like to picture it this way. If we would function whole as whole people, then the next thing that comes here is joy. Right? The ability to tap into joy and live in this world. Just like Jesus did. Jesus functioned that way. So I have four categories for church or people. Here we go. Life-giving, life-neutral, life-sucking, and life-destroying. Did I go through those too fast? You're all looking like, why are we here this afternoon? Life-giving, which is what I think what God gives us. He gives us back life. He moves us from death to what? To life. He says, I have come that you may have life and have it in abundance. He's telling us that you can be dead in your trespasses and sin, or you can live this life fully. So ideally, this is what the Christian life should look like. Guilt is gone. Now you're born, if you will, alive. You're made alive. And joy is the marker of how you live. No restraint, no limits, no nothing. Just pure joy. Joy is profoundly the perception of being alive, of tasting and savoring, witnessing it. Maybe this is going to be crazy response to you, but I've been at the last breath of half a dozen people, and I was at the birth of one of my children. The doctors wouldn't let me be at the others, and it's the same sensation for me. It's pure mystery at that point. And it's something you have no control over, and you are an observer, and you're not in control, and you have all these pieces of the puzzle. But it's profound at that point in time. We don't get there very often, I don't think. So this is no little deal. Where the lie comes is it looks like this. It looks like you have guilt. Okay, and then it's still taken away. So from a Christian perspective, if you're following Jesus, that's the same. But now what happens is that Satan's tools are shame. And what follows shame is a lie of some kind. Okay? Because the lie takes on power on the basis of shame. I have a book I would highly recommend somebody reading if you want to understand the role shame plays in this thing. Shame is the replacement for guilt. When it says in Romans 8, it says this, there's therefore now, put the word shame in there instead of condemnation. There is now no shame. The next time Paul uses the word condemnation in Romans is in chapter 14. Chapter 14 is where he's talking about the application of his theology, the first 11 chapters. And so now he's applying it. And when he gets to chapter 14 in Romans, it's a chapter about how do you make decisions in gray areas. Gray areas being not black or white, not either or, not all or none, not right or wrong, not moral or non-moral. Just choices. How do you know whether you should go here or not, or spend this or not, or have this conversation or not? And so Paul talks about that at the end of Romans 14, verse 23, reads like this. The faith that you have as your own conviction before God, or have as your own conviction before God. So your choice by faith before God, not before the results, not before the watching world, not before what everybody else thinks, but it's a personal relationship with God. So it begins to show you how hard it is to break through shame, because shame is built into the brokenness of the world, if you will. It's not part of God's economy originally, but it's part of what we have to deal with. So the lie attaches to shame. Shame's the powers it. The book I would recommend is written by a psychiatrist who's also a Christian. And I read 25 books about 2 years ago on shame. I'd rather read a novel, but anyway, I read 25 books on shame, and it's a shame. There are so many books written about him. Nevertheless, his was probably the best, most insightful because it took neuroscience and theology and put them together. And he's got some really penetrating insights about the role that shame plays, because it's the replacement for guilt. Does anybody here know a lady? She's an American sociologist called Brené Brown. Familiar with her? Well, she has two or three YouTube videos that just went viral about vulnerability and shame. They're great little nuggets based on research that she's done related to this. And but you want to take it a level thicker, if you will, then this is a book by Kirk Thompson, and it's called The Soul of Shame, S-O-U-L. And but what he does is he describes what goes on inside of us. I think what happened to David, for example, is that David wasn't capable, for some reason, of stepping over his shame. So even though he was fully forgiven by God and was willing to accept the consequences of what he chose to do, he did not step over shame. Shame beat him. And the way you know that is, as you go on in David's story, the sexual sin and the murder, the two things that occurred in the Bathsheba story, those two things show up in his own family with his boys. He had 19 named sons that we know of. Do you know what happened to the sons?
Fought each other.
Yeah, Absalom killed them all except for one, or two of them, I think. Fascinating family to live in, right? Wonderful family. And what did David do as a parent?
Nothing.
He was passive. Here's a guy that's a king, a warrior, a leader, a strategist, a musician, a poet, a writer, a jurist. You know, I mean, he was phenomenal until it came to interpersonal relationship with his family based on what had happened to him, and shame won the day. So if you take the trajectory of David's life, I think what happened is that shame wins the day and takes him out of the game. So that's what the lie does. The lie attaches itself to this, and you don't see shame. Shame doesn't want to be known, so that's why it's so slippery. But it feels like this. So guilt says you did something wrong. Shame says you are wrong. You're wrong. You know, one says, I did a bad thing. The other says, I'm bad. Okay? But that's not what God says. God says, you're my son. I'm so glad you've come home. We're going to have a party. I'm not convinced that the younger son enjoyed the party. Text doesn't say, so I can play with it. You can too. And we know the older brother didn't get to the party. But the celebration had to be had because the son came back. And I think, this is a long way to say, the lie is all that our adversary has, all that sin as a noun, as an entity has, to drive a wedge in our development. And so where sin plays its role is to keep us from accessing joy. Well, joy is still part of the picture. It just happens to wind up now over here. And in between comes the lie and any kind of agreement that we make. And an agreement is that the lie tells me something. The agreement then is my way of making sure that I don't get fooled by that again. And then on top of that comes fear and anger and depression. How am I doing? Are you all happy now? Then denial. Right? So you have, what you have.
Addiction then is an addictive thing that you have to work back through that.
Well, you have to disarm all this. Yeah. All that stuff acts as a barrier between what Christ did and what God gives us as a result of that. So this stuff is what I'm talking about, and I gave you just a tiny slice today by talking about what? Not being a victim anymore. If you can get a handle on how often you use that that language, and we all do.
We blame.
Well, that's victim language.
Yeah.
So being a victim or blaming. is all part of that. Why does the lie have that power? Because it blinds us through shame. It blinds us to what we've been given here. David was given the freedom to do the same thing with Amnon and Tamar that had been done to him. Amnon raped Tamar, brother, sister, by different mothers. Okay? So the sexual sin was right in David's face, and David was totally passive. But he could have done the very same thing that God did to him. I forgive you. There are going to be consequences. You have to own the consequences. You have to be responsible for your choices. You have to grow up. And that's essentially what he said, what God said to David as well. So that's my flimsy attempt to say, when the lie comes, why does it have such power? It has such power because it's designed to deceive us. And that's why revelation is so important, both written revelation, God's revelation, and then the Spirit in some way. Yeah.
One of the reasons perhaps that we struggle with the lie, knowing the truth, is that the lie always has an element of truth in it, and that's what the enemy likes to use against us. It's not because we know that we've been forgiven and saved that we're going to be perfect. And so there are some things that we struggle with over and over again, and that we're going to continue to struggle with over and over again until we leave these bodies. And they're inherently built into us as humans. The notion you spoke of earlier is, you know, us being control freaks, that's built into our survival mechanism, so we don't like to be in control, we don't like to fail. And for me, it's the enemy likes to say, okay, you failed at this again. So you haven't arrived. You're never going to arrive. Yes, I still feel this anger at times. Someone can still push this button in me, even though I know where it's coming from. But at the same time, they get me through that. The enemy gets me through that lie. I don't even know if I'm being coherent here. The enemy gets me through that lie because there's a grain of truth in it. Yes, I have failed yet again. And that's why I have to keep reminding myself over and over again to not get into this scheme of fear and dread and all the rest of that. You have to stop and say, part of it is... Yeah, and the shame, part of it is we are going to keep failing at some things, and we're going to have to accept that. So it's tied up in our human pride as well.
The piece that I would echo, the core of that, is that you can't have a lie without the truth. Right? You can't have evil without good. Okay? So you have to understand that piece of it. So this is always an addition. The challenge here is to offload this stuff because it's worthless. So shame's message to you is that you use language like you failed again, or Nancy's term of, you know, I've got an addiction, so now I'm back on I fell off the wagon, you know, I stay on it for a while and then I fall off of it, you know, and it doesn't matter what you're addicted to, okay? So yes, I don't know that those are built into us. I think they're part of the original lie that just keeps pushing us to say, you can be God. You can control this. And when you don't, then you're a failure. That's shame's message, right? But not in God's economy. I have a friend who was the president of a seminary, the seminary I get to teach at in Denver, for years, probably 40 years. And he wrote an article, he says, faith to face failure, or what's so great about success? And his whole point was, failing is a major component of learning. Watch a baby learn how to walk. Kaboom! You know. If I sat down like a baby, I wouldn't get up. You know, I mean, but they're built to do that, right? So they fail over and over and over again until what? Till they finally walk. And I think we have labeled failure, part of shame gives us this message, that somehow failure means you're less than, or there's something broken in you, or whatever. And it's a stopper. And it's because what God gives you when he gets rid of the guilt, he gives you access back into how he designed you originally, which is a full-orbed person who functions like he does, who thinks like he does, who has an imagination like he does, who can be creative like God is. He wants us to be in relationship with him as well. So you're right. However we play at this, you'll see shame making the same message over and over again. Here it is again. You haven't accomplished a thing. So if you can be in the present, right? Not trying to be perfect now, but if you can be in the present moment, that's where grace is. That's where mercy resides. That's where forgiveness lies. That's where joy is found. Anxiety is always outside of that moment. So it's easy for us to get drawn out of the moment and think about the future, what it might be like or what I might do, et cetera, and that stops us. The lie is fascinating. For instance, if a person is sexually abused, the normal reaction to sexual abuse, which is, some violation of you, the normal reaction to that is, I must have done something to deserve it. There must be something in me that made this happen. There must be, have you ever heard somebody say, well, everything happens for a reason? That's a patently non-biblical statement. Evil doesn't happen for a reason. It's evil. That's why it's nonsense. But people will come away from an experience like that and can't step out of it because they're saying, what my experience was, that's outside of them, my experience is telling me the truth. Well, if you're going to renew your mind, you have to talk back to that. So people will go to counseling for years. I had a young lady who had been violated, and she was violated by her father for years, used as a surrogate spouse, and she was now married, and she was trying to work through how to have a robust whole life with her husband, and they just could not get over the sexual stuff. I mean, it was just in the way. So what we worked on was the shame that she felt in the agreements that she had made. She knew what the lie was, but it was the agreement that killed her. The agreement was, I can't feel any pleasure because if I do, I will be validating what happened to me. Well, that's quite an attachment, isn't it? I will never enjoy sex again because it was taken away from me at this time. I had two gals in Texas. One came, and then the other about 3 months later. They're about the same age. And after listening to them for a while, I realized their stories were almost identical. They'd both been raped by two guys in a parking lot, in a van, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So finally, I got them together. And they actually caught the guys, and I think they're still in jail. Okay, but one gal said this. She said, I'm ruined. That's the lie, right? I'm ruined. There's no way I can recover. I'm not okay. Who would want me now? The other gal said, I didn't choose this. You know, I don't have a disease. I'm not pregnant. I wasn't hurt. You know, I'm functionally a virgin. She just took a whole other road. Same event, two different what? Perspectives, right? So where's the battle? It's in the way we think.
Growing up and being a whole person and realizing that you belong to Jesus. You know, I mean, for the longest time, I wanted to be accepted by whoever, you know, growing especially in high school or whatever. And over and over and over again, I had to say, I hate you, devil. Get away from me. That's not true. You love me, and I belong to you.
Maybe.
And that's I think for me, it was over and over again, I had to shoo him away because it says, if you reject him, he will flee from you. Mm-hmm. And I believe in the spiritual warfare that we have to deal with as believers in Jesus. Mm-hmm. Because he is deceptive, that not Jesus, but the enemy is deceptive, and he will get us at our weakest point.
Well,
he'll
confirm somebody's statement to you. You know, like a lot of people have messages in their childhood where some teacher said, "Well, you shouldn't take this class. You know, you're not smart enough to do that. Just go dig ditches or something." You know, and some people fight through that, and some people cave into it. But it's a surreptitious message from outside again, where nobody's encouraging you to tap into your own stuff. And I think there's a medieval catechism for baptism. And the catechism class took, I think, 2 years, maybe three. I don't remember exactly. And so it's a long class before you could be baptized in the church. And then when you were baptized, the day of your baptism was a big celebration. And so here's the baptismal, and you were to turn your back to the baptismal, face away from it, and renounce Satan and all his works, and spit in his face, literally spit in his face, and then turn around and be baptized. And the symbolism is, that's our role. Our role is to continually spit in the face of shame, because shame cannot tell you the truth, ever. And shame says there's something wrong with you, there's something bad, there's something defective, something, and it says you are bad. And so it's so qualitatively different that what I want you to hear from this is that God gives you a new heart. God, so you don't have a heart that deceives you. You only have one heart. It's a new heart. He's written the law on it. It's flesh, not stone. He changed, you know, all those imageries in Scripture are given to us so we can understand that he's done that work already. Our job is to offload all this garbage in between. And it comes in a genuine form, very personal. So you're right on the money, I think, when you say the lie has to have veracity attached to it by playing off of the truth in some way. This event happened, you know. But it's a little bit like in school when I was teaching, we had a kid that got caught fighting, and so into his record went that he was a fighter. What's wrong with that statement? Yeah, it was a judgment. It was a label, right? You now are a fighter. That's shame talking instead of just allowing him to have had a fight and leave it at that, not give him the label. The label makes the thinking circular, okay? So why is Johnny a fighter? Well, because he fights. Well, why does he fight? Well, because he's a fighter. We don't have to think anymore. We've pinned him in that, and we can shame him as a result. God does not do that. He loves us. But the prodigal son, when he comes home, even though he's given a robe and a ring and a new credit card and a car or whatever, you know, I mean, he doesn't necessarily, the story doesn't tell you what he does with his shame. Does a little bit. I'm not worthy to be your son. See him arguing that? He said, I need to come home. I want to come home. I know I was wrong. So I'm going to give up sonship in order to get back. You don't have to sacrifice. Jesus sacrificed for you. You have to get rid of this stuff. So you have to learn to renounce it. And so in Hebrews chapter 12, where it says, Jesus, who for the joy set before him, endured the cross. What's the next line? Despised the shame. Scorned the shame. That word despised or scorned means the very same thing that I was telling you just a second ago. You actively seek out shame and spit in its face. Renounce it. You have to see it and then say it and tell it to go away because it's not telling you the truth.
This is much the same as the Job story with all of his comforters they were right and they had the answers. And they were accusing him of, he must have been doing something wrong, or God would never do this to him.
Yeah, the Job story is his accusers said Job was to blame. Job said, finally, God was to blame. Both were wrong. Does that make sense? And God's answer isn't just this cut and dried little thing. He says, you need a better perspective. You need a bigger perspective. So he gives him a lesson about birds and leviathans and all kinds of stuff. And
make the snow?
Yeah. I mean, he just changes the perspective. That's why when Paul says, be transformed by what? The way you see something. It's not the event that does it. It's how you see that event, what role it plays. And the lie gets lodged because there's attachments to it. And it's the attachments that keep it alive. So you have to figure out what the vow is that you've made to the lie that you will never do that again. Almost everybody has a jilted lover story. Like, you know, I loved somebody in junior high school and then they hurt me. And that doesn't feel good. Rejection never feels good, right? So most people then make a vow inside of themselves that I will never take that risk again because it's too painful. So people go through life with a thinned out relational diagram. And, you know, and they think, okay, well, I'm not going to risk this because it's too risky. The garden was full of risk, folks. And so I just think that's, well, you have to get up and go after it again. You know, get up and get back on the horse. Get up and it's no, there's no shame in falling off the horse. There's no shame in failure. There's no shame in that.
Arna, that was an amazing question.
Yeah, you shouldn't have asked the first question, I guess, so, since I'm still on it. Is that helpful at all?
Yeah.
All right, let's try this.
Brain is naturally negative and that it gets programmed for a baby that, up until 18 months old. That determines whether he will be fear-based or joy-based the rest of his life. And I think that's really daunting for a parent, to know.
Especially if your child's 19 months old.
It's even more
sorry.
Has a baby, how do you care for that baby so that it will be joy-based and not fear-based?
Wow.
And if you haven't done that with your child or if it has not been done for you, how do you overcome the fear-based life?
Oh, man. So she's asking a question about... well, this will be my interpretation of your question. She's asking a question about how do you retrain your brain when it's been... twisted in one direction, especially the negative direction.
But also, what is it that one needs to do to avoid that for one's child?
Okay, there's two things. You can avoid it some, and you can, but there's no guarantee. Here's the problem: we are relational creatures. So, as a parent, you can be perfectly, if it's possible, you can be a perfect parent and offer all this grace and mercy to your child, and your child still has a responsibility to pick it up. So you only have half of the equation. A parent can't control the outcome, but we can do the best on our side. And I think that's exactly what God does in the garden. He does perfect with his children. And we're still scratching our head. Why didn't they go back and talk to him? Hey, there's a snake over here. And he asked that, and what about this? But they didn't have that dialogue. They didn't process. And all we get is the result, right? The mixed up fallen world as a result. So I think it's the same process. The way the brain functions, why it's negative, why we say it's built to be negative, is it's self-protective. It will do whatever it needs to protect the individual. So if you have an individual that's sensitive, then they're gonna have a protective system that goes off a whole lot earlier than somebody that's not so sensitive. And we've had three babies, and Nancy says one baby, our first, was slow in the womb, just turned over really slowly and didn't have much to do, and just was kind of easy going. And then the next one's kicking and brass, and they come out, and sure enough, that's the way they're wired, you know, and you go, wow, you know, here it is. It's happening before, you know. So the negative part, the comment about the negative part of the brain is that it's designed to self-protect us. But that self-protection usually is what gets us in trouble when it comes to growth and development. I can't control what the child receives, but I can control what I offer them. So you offer them as much nurture as you can. The first 18 months, the child should be delighted in. And I think that's really what you need to do with children. Every time I do this little bit, people get mad at me. But here we go. You ready? Don't say you're proud of your kids. Tell them you delight in them. Pride and praise go together. Only God's worthy of praise. Your children long to be delighted in, and it sets them free, and it keeps them from all the crazy side effects of praise. So it's just a little tiny tidbit, but it matters big time. I've seen kids turn around radically when somebody just delights in them. I love to watch you play the piano. I love to watch you play football. I love to watch you be creative. You're so fun to watch. Wow. That's a different message than the one that says, wow, you got that one right. Now, they've got to live up to that, don't they? And it's subtle, but it's deadly. Okay, so back to your question. What we now know neuroscience-wise is that you can actually retrain the brain to access joy. And there's probably one group has like 19 functions, which I don't remember and I can't list for you right now, but there are 19 actual functions. And some of them are practicing. Looking as an adult, you can practice how you think about. That's what we're doing right here. I'm giving you the opportunity to think about practicing your victim language and how you position yourself when you blame somebody. And the best place for you is when you're alone and driving on the freeway. Check out what's going on in your head based on some guy that cut you off. Do you offer him copious amounts of gentle kindness? Or are there other thoughts, you know, that you might have, etc.? Okay, so there are ways that you can practice this and actually move from fear to joy. So you're not stuck. I'm just saying that the opening season for a child's development should be that they receive love and delight. Now, one person said it this way. He said, when people become new believers, when they first are born into the family of God, they should enjoy being babies. But typically what we do with new believers is we put them in a class, don't we? And we teach them that they should pray every day and read the Bible every day and tell people about Jesus every day. And right away, we give them tasks to do. It would be like taking your baby and say, now, make your bed and, you know, clean up your toys. And, you know, and the kid's saying, I just crapped in my pants. I need help, you know. What's wrong with you? Did I say that? I didn't mean to say that. Erase that. No, it's in my back pocket. I'm sorry. Okay, so what we've learned neuroscience-wise is that you can literally, and this is really from trauma research, this is what the beauty of trauma research is that now we know that people that have been traumatized and have PTSD, etc., almost always it's because of some unprocessed something from their childhood, okay? So usually it's not a traumatic event in the moment, it's opening up trauma events out of their past that haven't been processed, in the sense that you can stand in the face of shame and renounce it, because the trauma doesn't tell you who you are. The trauma doesn't tell you what kind of a person you are. I mean, I know people who have who are quadriplegics or paraplegics, and some of them, that's the end of their life. They got no place to go. And others choose to continue to live. And people want to be around them because they're so alive. It's not the event that determines your response. And so you have an array of things that you can do. And I think with kids, it's to delight in them, actually. And so one of the things for new believers is, you know, helping them be babies and play and just delight in it. There's a time to say no eventually in a kid's life. There's a place for that, but probably not in the first 18 months. Right? So I think that's what we're up against. And so what the science is telling you, yes, you can actually come back against this stuff. And there's things, subtle little things we notice. Almost every traumatized person or a lot of people that are fear-based, their stance is shoulders forward and head down. So now we're talking about body memories. Now we're talking about how your body actually carries this stuff. And so now we know that if you push your shoulders back and down and hold your head up, your body, your mind actually can't produce some negative emotions as a result. That's pretty powerful, isn't it? Just changing your body posture changes your emotional state. Taking your arms in an argument and actually putting them down, relaxing them and putting them down, will change the way you argue. I should get paid for that one. Somebody should just send a donation to something, you know, just because. But that's what we're learning about the physiology, is that it matters. Right? So the way you carry yourself matters. And you can see it in people. You can see it in the way they walk. You can see it in the way they posture themselves. And, you know, even the way we probably make choices about dress and et cetera, et cetera. Okay, so I don't know if that's poking at that a little bit, but you can delight in this kid, love them, nurture them. It's the nurturing that's so significant. And I think we placed a high value on rescuing people. Somebody was saying, you know, about fixing. guys are fixers. We want to solve a problem. But relationships are not problems to be solved. People aren't problems to be solved. We're much more complex than that. And so it's learning how to lean into the messiness of a relationship. And relationships are always messy. Always messy.
Can you talk about the container exercise, even though... No. There are singles in here?
Well, I can, but this is not the place, probably.
Oh, okay.
But maybe.
It's very important.
If it comes up again.
Yeah.
Is that helpful?
Yeah.
Try again.
Into much detail about how to retrain. We can retrain ourselves.
It's so unique to individuals where they are that's probably what makes it hard. But you have to practice. I would say... Yep. I would say we are so quick nowadays. Our devices make us impatient. You know, I remember when I first got a computer to download a page was maybe, sometimes if it was a complicated page, it'd take an hour, 30 minutes to an hour. Do you remember those days, dial-up? Come on. Some of you, don't leave me up here all by myself. Yeah. Some people know about dial-up from a distance. So now, I mean, check your patience level. Do you click off of something if it doesn't download in a hurry? I mean, right here in our room, I'm going, come on, signal, get up here, you know. Act right, you know. Well, because we're so quick, we don't understand. Most of this kind of transformation, if you will, takes a long time. You don't just bounce back from this. There's a movie we just saw made by some guys that wrote the book, The Cure. I don't know if you're familiar with that. The Cure is about grace, and I would highly, highly recommend you read it.
True Faith.
It's one of the very best books I've ever read about grace. And it's because grace is so disturbing to us, it's very hard. A lot of people can write about grace. This is the first book I know that talks about the application of grace, and it's after all the application of this stuff that matters. So, and which I'm inadequately answering your child question, but it's called The Cure, and it's not the band.
Do you know who wrote
John,
it?
Yeah,
John Lynch,
L-Y-N-C-H, McNichol, M-C-N-I-C-O-L, and Thrall. T-H-R-A-L-L. You'll find it. But in that book, they made this movie, and it's called The Heart of Man. And...
They get it here.
We couldn't see it.
We can't see it here.
Yeah, well, you'll get a hold of it eventually.
Well, it was only in 600 theaters on Thursday 3 weeks ago.
Fancy.
So it's hard. But I think they give it to churches and so forth.
Well, it'll be available eventually. But anyway, the point I want to make in the movie is they had two or three examples of marriages that had been violated through betrayal, okay, through sexual betrayal. So you had adultery going on and all this kind of stuff. And then at the end of the movie, the movie's broken up with these interviews with these people, okay? And the couples or the guys that are the perpetrators or, you know, however you want to talk about it. And what was fascinating was they were talking about how it's a process, okay? So one couple said it took 11 years before they came out of the tunnel. Another couple got a divorce and then remarried after like 6 years themselves. I mean, they divorced and then 6 years later they remarried. And they were talking about how hard it was still today, but they were, you know, by this time they were 10, 15 years into the process. We want the process to be immediate. The problem is the traumatic stuff starts early, and a lot of it is pre-programmed into us even multi-generationally. So the more we learn about the brain, the more fascinating this becomes, I think. Because the brain's plastic, you can retrain it. That's the good news. Does it take a long time? Sometimes, yeah, really long time. Is it worth it? Of course it is. So I hope that's not too convoluted a response, but there's just this cascading rush of data now that we're getting good data that says this works, this matters. You can build different off-ramps off of your brain processing. You can actually talk back to your brain because it is not, it's different than your mind. Your mind is what makes you human. And it's a different process than just being brain and wetware, you know, that kind of stuff. So
a personal example is, over the years, since I was brought up with shame, I learned how to shame really well. I was good at it. And so I had to renounce this over and over and over. And it's just been recently that I've said to HUD, you know, I'm going to be kind to you. That may sound funny, but I think that is a choice. Because as believers, we have the fruit of the Spirit within us. Faithfulness, gentleness, goodness, self-control, those nine attributes, but we don't access them. We're peacekeepers. Well, that's, you know, we just hide things. And instead of being peacemakers and bringing it to the light and saying, you know, for the last few months, he doesn't know what to do with me because I'm kind to him. And it's a choice. It's accessing.
Can I trust her?
Mm-hmm.
How long will this last? When will this snaky, snarky, shame-based show up? Yeah. Okay, we have a front row question here, and then a second row question. Yeah.
Well, it's only that it's perhaps a popular thing, but it talks about we can allow spirits of something to come into us, a spirit of depression, of anxiety. And I suppose in my own life, as I look back, I realised I had allowed, or I had been, I have felt abandoned all my life. And so it made me think, is it at this place of agreement, where
sure
we
is.
Allow a spirit to come into us? And yet I believe the trigger to it for me was the fact I was very nearly miscarried when I was 6 months into the term, and it was something that I've had to stand against all my life.
Exactly. She's talking about what are the roots of the gives lie power, if you will. Mm-hmm. And I had, fascinating to me from a counseling standpoint is how many people have been orphaned in some way, and how an orphan fights to have a sense of identity because it's messed up at the beginning. Mm-hmm. And so we're back to the talking about those first 18 months. You think a kid doesn't understand that early on? They do. Their body understands it, and so they respond to it in these ways. And you get these crazy messages. And then attached to that a lot of times are messages within a family. I talked to a gal, she was a seven-figure earning person in a large company in Denver, and she was from Asia, and she'd been adopted, and everything in her life was fine except her personal life. It was a disaster, and she could not get past the abandonment issues as a child. Now, at some point, she's got to start standing against that, because you can't go back and unabandon her. No. You can't change the storyline. Mm-hmm. So back to my why I chose victimhood for you is you either believe that you are the victim of circumstances outside of you, events outside of you, what's been said and done or left out of your world outside of you, or you believe you have the power to respond back to that. And so many of us, I mean, as a young parent, I wasn't very nurturing. I wasn't. I loved my kids, but I loved them with an inadequate response out of my own lack of development. My first two kids, I still feel sorry for them, you know. And here's a nice piece of the puzzle. Our firstborn, I was telling Marna here yesterday, the firstborn children don't have a chance, you know. I think they ought to be really... If I was going to say something about God's design, it would be that he would give us a practice child, you know, just one that you could kind of dispose of and then get on with the real job of parenting. I don't mean that in any kind of kind way, but I just think, oh my goodness, you know, if I could go back and do this again. Well, God actually gave us two more chances with our kid when he was an adult, came back through our life twice. And so you have it's like, yeah, you did okay, but you might want to try this again. So here he comes, you know, he comes, lives with us a little longer, and then we have another chance to pour into his life, hopefully a stronger message of delight than we got to him the first time. My first message to my first child was, you could do this better. What were you thinking? You missed this. Yeah. Awful, awful message. Yeah, awful messages instead of, way to go. I'm glad you're out there on the field doing this, man. Most people don't even get out there, you know. So it's that message that really is the core. And then the question is, can the kid receive it? So it's got to be delivered in a way that the child can receive it. And different children receive stuff differently. So parents have a responsibility to lay stuff down, to produce and lay stuff down, let go of it. And the kid has a responsibility to pick it up. And I just think when that gets fouled up, then you have to pay attention to it, because it bubbles up in our souls over and over again. And when it's there, you need to pay attention to it, and then you need to call it out. Because none of this stuff, here's the antidote. And this is the antidote across the board. The antidote to all sin is the same. Expose it to the light. No sin can tolerate exposure to the light. You want the antidote to pornography? Invite your whole family down to watch it with you next time. Take care of it, guarantee. I mean, we think it's a big mystery. That stuff's not a mystery. Sin is blunt junk. But we think it's because it gets this crazy hold, and the only way it has access to your soul is through shame. It doesn't come in any other direction. I'm confident that that's the grabber. That's the glue that attaches it. And then Satan just lets it do its work, and he goes off because he's on me nothing. He has to go off and mess with somebody else. And when you spit in his face and say, this is not the truth, God says, I'm his child, and I'm delightful to him. And he loves me, and he wants me to come play with him. Where are you, Adam? Let's go have a coffee. Let's get going again. This is going to be a rough ride, and you're going to need some friends, and I'm going to be a friend with you. Let's do it. I mean, that's a whole different message than I would have given Adam. Sorry. I didn't give my firstborn that. I shamed him. I said, what were you thinking? What? Come on.
And of course, he had learning disabilities, which made it worse. And being a psychologist, you'd think,
hey,
we'd understand. Learning,
hey, who's this woman talking over here? Hey, stop that. But yeah, exactly.
Well, it's individual. You know, he came back when we celebrated his 50th birthday, and we had just gone to a pastor's.
My 50th birthday.
Yeah, your 50th birthday. And we had just been to a pastor's, what was it called? A Galatians 6:6 or something. And boy, I worked on a lot of stuff that I didn't get from my dad and I didn't get from my mother. And I cried and cried and whatever. But then we took those emotional, what do you call them?
Needs.
Emotional needs, which everyone has, no matter where you're from or what country you're from.
Need for approval and acceptance and love and
so,
you know,
forth. And that kind of thing. They're about 30, whatever. And we told him about the first, you know, 6 or 7. And we said, did you get that from us? No, he didn't get it from either of us. Did you get that? No, he didn't get that from us. He didn't get those emotional needs met from us, his mom or his dad. And then he said, you know, but I couldn't pick him up. I didn't have.
It's not that you didn't give him. He said I couldn't receive
him. It's not that you didn't give him. It's just that I didn't know.
So the first act in development, which is the child 18 months, is they have to be able to receive something. And too often, we don't leave them infant long enough, if you will. I think we do the same thing with people in the church. We don't let them grow in their relationship, their new relationship with Jesus. We don't let them, you know, flop around and be babies, you know, for a while. We try to put them in school right away. And I just think we miss so much of this joyful playing that we've been talking about a little bit. Play is a huge piece of the puzzle because it's a celebratory side of life. It's delight. Anyway, okay. Yeah.
I do. It might relate some to what we talked about with circumstances or victims or blame, but I think you referenced 1 John 1:5, which is, this is the message we have heard from him and announced to you, that God is light and in him there's no darkness at all. So God is not the author of evil, or God does not generate evil. So then my question is, how do we define evil?
That's nonsense. It's taking something that's good and twisting it, or adding something to it, just like the lie. It's that same form. So Paul has a phrase he uses in Timothy, 1 Timothy 4:4. He says, everything God created is good. When, and this is my translation, when it's used the way it's designed to be used. Okay? So you are using the chair you're sitting in the way it's designed to be used. Could I stand on it and change a light bulb?
Sure.
Should I? At your age, old man, you really think you should do that? Why shouldn't I stand on a chair to change the light bulb?
It's dangerous.
It's dangerous because I would not be using the chair the way it's designed to be used. Everything God created is good when it's used the way it's designed to be used. Sex is a wonderful thing. But for most people, it's not very good because it's been distorted in some way. It's not that sex is bad. It's that the use of it, or the misuse of it, or the abuse of it, or the, you know, the denial of it, or doesn't matter. There's been some distortion. I could take a pen, and the pen that you have, and I could kill you with it, or I could write you a check or a poem, or, you know, if I use the pen the way it's designed, I'm in a different ball game. And I think evil will not make sense. And the problem is we try to make sense out of it. We try to make it make sense. Now, why did this happen? Why did this happen to me? Why does this keep happening to us? Why so much of this stuff? Well, we're in this raging war, and war doesn't play by our rules. War is war, and it's a fog, and it's not fair, And Satan, what? Wants to steal, kill, and destroy. Why are we surprised? Should a believer in Jesus be surprised if they get cancer? Absolutely not. You should hate it. And you should have confidence that God hates it too. And he doesn't want it. But he didn't cause it. And he doesn't generate it. And he doesn't, you know, can he teach you a lesson through it? Probably. But he certainly doesn't need it to teach you a lesson. So he can redeem it. Nobody else can, because the evil's just stupid. I had 4 lawsuits professionally a number of years ago. I used to not want to tell this story, because it doesn't sound good, does it? Well, this guy's got 4 lawsuits. What's that mean? You know, well, it's really, you know. And so you apply all kinds of labels to that. And what I learned through that, as I struggled theologically, I was trying to think, now, what am I supposed to learn from this? And I was telling a fellow psychologist about this one time, and he got up to get some more coffee and another Danish, and he said, it's just spiritual warfare. Don't try to make it make any sense. Yeah. It's just spiritual warfare. It's, in other words, you're in a battle. This does not make sense. It's not about being fair. It's war. And the other person, this entity, this sin that we're against, it's Jesus or God in us against that entity. It's not inside of us, it's outside of us. And we have to battle the outside part. And so, but it shows up in our thinking. It shows up in these messages we get from our families of origin, It's crazy that we don't process this stuff better. So I love the passage in Timothy that says everything God created is good. When you figure out how to sanctify it, how to use it the way it's designed to be used. And he says this, with the word of God and prayer. So the word of God's objective, prayer's subjective. Joyously giving thanks or something like that. Thankfulness is part of that equation. So he says if you're going to redeem the stuff that God made, which includes you, then you have to pay some attention to who you are and how he made you and how you're shaped and what, and then you have to figure out what's the redemptive side of this. Because there, you know, most guys that are angry, there's a redemptive side to their anger, but they don't know how to get to it because all they've been is angry, and the anger is the cover-up and keeps them from being able to access their own souls, and so it's destructive. Anger's worthless for us.
And so often, I think, as a believer, we think that God is at one end of the continuum and Satan is at the other end of the continuum, but he is a creative being, so God is over all. He's the king of the world. But the prince of the principalities and powers is in control of our world right now. But God, you know, it's so interesting to me because we give him the same kind of power that we give God himself.
We give him the wrong weight, yeah.
God is over all.
Significant.
Are there some examples, though, in the Bible where, like David's son, for instance, who dies, where you see behind the scenes that God is doing things?
Well...
like if we say all sickness is evil... and God doesn't cause sickness because God is not the author of evil. Does that always line up with?
Well, you won't get a formula. Number one. Number two. If we look, I have too many thoughts. If you slow down, if you look at, say, God's parenting style, it's really crazy making. Huh? He seems really loose and, you know, in some settings and then really tight in other settings, you know, and you're going, whoa, what's that all about? I think it bears a tighter scrutiny, if you will, so that God's not a cosmic coin-op machine. And my question to you would be, does God need to intervene? Sorry, I just want to mess with your heads a little bit. Does God need to intervene to be God? He does sometimes. There's obvious examples of it in Scripture, but it's far from the norm. And most of us want to make it norm, the norm, that he's constantly intervening. I think what he does is he trusts the way he made you. He trusts your mind. He trusts you to use it for his glory. He needs you to partner with him. Now, that's a whole different paradigm. And it's him growing you up. It's him allowing you to build your life, if you will, and he will help you in league with him use it. He's got you in this world to be a part of his redemptive answer. If we can but get a hold of that. But we're so often navel-gazing and looking at our own sin that we miss the opportunity to be witnesses and instruments of peace and bringing joy to the setting. And just like Nancy said, you know, she said, I can be kind. Wow. I taught a sermon a few years back on gentleness. And I'll talk a little bit about that tomorrow. It was probably the simplest sermon I've ever taught, ever. I got more feedback on that crazy sermon than anything else, and I'm still irritated by it. I worked really hard on some things, you know, and it just went right by everybody, and they said, nice, good for you, you know. But this one, and I just thought, wow, you know, and that's the piece of the puzzle, I think, for me. Instead of trying to find a formula like, why does God seem to work in this family and not the other? C.S. Lewis says, why does God seem to answer prayers of new believers more frequently than he does old believers' prayers? Lewis says, I don't know, but maybe he can trust the old believer so he doesn't have to run around solving his problem all the time. And if you want to read a fun story, read Daniel chapter 10. Daniel chapter 10 is probably the only time in Scripture you get this just crazy insight into there's another world out there that's happening simultaneously with our world, and it affects our world, and we don't see it. And that's why he says, you're not fighting against flesh and blood, but you're fighting against principalities and powers. And in Daniel chapter 10, Daniel, who's arguably probably the best prayer in all of Scripture, right? Daniel in the lion's den, pretty effective, right? Daniel in Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, yeah, pretty effective. Daniel against Nebuchadnezzar, yeah, pretty effective. Uh-huh, he's in the king's palace, you know. He's made prayer a, you know, national thing. And so he prays, chapter 10. And he fasts, and he doesn't eat, and he doesn't drink, and, you know, and it's 21 days, and he's kind of coming out of this trance or whatever it is, and this angel comes and says, Daniel, we heard you 3 weeks ago, but we've been busy. I've been fighting off this angel demon from Persia, and I got Michael to stand in for me so I could come and tell you. And I'm going to go back here in a minute and we'll finish off the Persian guy now, and then we got to fight the angel demon from Greece. But we just wanted you to know that we did hear your prayer 21 days ago. Read it. It is absolutely crazy-making chapter. And then it just says goodbye, you know. And you go, what was that? But it's a little glimpse into there's more going on than you see on the surface. And so I think so often in Scripture we want a formula of some kind. I just don't think formulas are ours to have. Life doesn't come as that, you know. And so I think what God does is he trusts you. And that's overwhelming to me. I always thought that the challenge for me was to learn how to trust God. But really, it's to learn that he trusts you. He trusts the way he made you. He trusts you to carry his redemptive message into this world. He trusts you. He trusts you to build your life in a way that represents well what life is supposed to be, tasty and passionate and full of laughter and joy. And yeah, I don't hate it. I really am disturbed by us all getting really quiet when we do communion. Now, Jesus, please come be with us now. That's it was supposed to be a party. It was at a dinner. Okay, I'm sorry. That was just total editorial. We're going to edit this, right? Thank you. Go ahead.
It's a totally different question. Is that all right?
It's fine.
Yeah, I was really intrigued by something you said in the last session on living as a whole person. And you seem to suggest again at the beginning of this session that, correct me if I'm wrong, that it was that we need not think of ourselves as broken or as bad. And
wounded.
Nancy, I thank you for sharing. Like you, I grew up in a really, really tough family. I mean, it was the Addams Family on crack. Right? So I grew up also in a shamed environment.
You guys should eat dinner together and compare notes, that's all.
I grew up in a shamed environment, and unfortunately, I did a lot of that with my own children when they were younger. And, you know, I only began to change that and heal from that when I recognized in myself that I wasn't whole and that I was broken, and that, you know what, that was okay, that I was never going to be whole, and it wasn't about my being whole, it was about my accepting the, I mean, I couldn't accept the grace that was extended to me until I stopped trying to be whole and stopped seeing myself as different from everyone else and realized that everyone else that I cross in the road, that I walk by in the street, is also broken in some way, no matter what they are showing me. And so, in a way, again, it goes back to the pride thing. If I'm kind of disturbed because I feel like if I'm my goal is to be a whole person, then I'm worried about falling into pride because I think I need to remember personally that I'm never going to be whole.
I would change that paradigm just a little bit. I think you are. I think that's what God's making you whole. But the hubris or the pride piece is what shame tells you, right?
Yeah.
And it tells you that you should strive to be whole. And that's not the ballgame at all. I think you've got to shift the paradigm from striving to stewardship. How do I steward what God's given me? And that includes your story. None of you are your history. You are not your history. And the other line I would say, and which is what you're poking at, which is look at people as wounded, not bad. Because the bad piece is the shame piece. People are wounded. We're all wounded. It's what you do with the woundedness. And Paul says it this way. He says in Ephesians 4, 17, something like that. He says, speaking the truth in love. Nancy, don't answer. What's the next line? How many of you have heard that line, though? Speaking the truth in love. Yeah, have you heard it?
Yes. Grow up into always.
Thereby grow up. Therefore grow up. And then the next line is, in all aspects. Now what does all aspects mean? That's wholeness, isn't it? Name an aspect that doesn't fit under all. Sexual, emotional, financial, familial, historical, economical, sociological, psychological. You know, name one thing that doesn't fit under that. And he's telling you, your job, should you choose to accept it, is to steward all of that. Now, what God does is he wants you to be whole. He's telling you, I'm putting you back together. I'm going to complete you, if you will. I'm going to set you on that road. So it's just semantics. I'm not arguing with your point. Your point's wonderful. But I think we stay wounded. That's true. So did Jesus. But what the wound should show you is that God's healing power leaves a scar. So you can remember that it's by grace you're saved, and it's his mercies that are new every day, and that's what gets us through this stuff. And so you can then you can approach Satan and spit in his face and say, just get the heck out of here.
I was going to say, it makes it easier when you sort of fall back into bad behaviors, and he's there to say, see, you did it again. And yeah, okay, I did it again, but I'm forgiven again, and I am going to keep progressing.
Absolutely.
Outside of his body at some point, but I'm going to keep walking towards
that.
And that's incredibly freeing.
Working out of the best of us.
Exactly.
Yeah. And that's by the way, that's one of the hardest things to do, to work out the best in you. But it's a great model if you can get it in your head, you know. Was that the best in me? I tell this story, Nancy doesn't like it, but so just stay out of it, please. I think you can't deceive yourself, you can't be self-deceived unless you self-betray. Okay? So self-deception, which plays a big role in that middle, that big barrier block I've got up there, self-deception only occurs when self-betrayal is there. A great example would be King Saul was self-deceived. Okay, so just read his story. Oh, I did do all everything that, you know, I was told that Samuel told me to do. I did all that. Well, guess again. So
he said, "Where are all these bleeding men?"
Yeah, exactly. He was supposed to kill them all and didn't, you know. So he self-deceived. Okay, so
took a little bit. Good
stuff. Okay, so the point is, self-betrayal means that I have to somehow violate me, which means that you're not working out the best in you. And here's my example. I have a rail in my house, and Nancy has some back issues, and so going up and downstairs is not wonderful. And I say I love her, you know, or at least I did one time when we were getting married. And so, you know, so oftentimes I'll stop at the top of the stairs and I see things on the rail that I know Nancy wants downstairs. And maybe I'm a little tweaked at her because she wasn't kind that particular day. This was before her kindness period. And, you know, and so I'm standing there at the top of the stairs and I have to make a decision. You know what the decision is, don't you? It's she will carry him down if I don't do it. But if I work out of the best in me, I might go up and downstairs two or three times just to get the stuff downstairs. Because why? I love her. And I won't be betraying myself because I know that's the loving thing to do. But I'll betray myself if I pretend I didn't see him. Or does that make sense? You can't play in this world without it coming at you in a thousand different ways. And so I think you just have to keep pushing back against it. And the more you get that clear in your head that God's wild about you, he is absolutely wild about you. And when you're wild about a kid, kid's going to get the message. Eventually he's going to get it somehow. He's not going to miss it. My dad was wild about me. Wow. Well,
when I was doing my master's degree, there was...
We've got to go. We're actually done.
I know. But it was... what makes a healthy child or helps a healthy child, in addition to your question, to love them unconditionally, which is impossible, but love them, delight in them, and then give them boundaries. Kids today don't have any boundaries. They just do whatever feels good. And then within those boundaries, give them their own choice to make, you know, to fail, if you will.
That's really just the biblical model, right? God is wild about us, sets limits on us and says, you're finite, and then says, go for it. But most of us are waiting for some kind of plan or telegram or something to tell us what to do next. And I just think a lot of the silence is God saying, in essence, I'm just waiting for you to go for it. I'll be with you. I want to see what kind of house you're going to build. You know, where do you want to live? Oh, great. Let's go there. You know, sorry. Can I pray?
Yeah.
Quickly. Would you like that?
Just a very short yes or no question. Would you consider shame to be a sin?
No. Let's pray. Wow. Thanks, Father. Really, really protect these people from this hour and a half. You've given all of us so much unique to us, so much unique to our worlds, because you know what we need to face and process those intersections that you give to us with other people, whether it be in the grocery store, just in a single sentence that we may never see that person again, to an ongoing relationship that's lasted decades and decades and decades. We give you thanks for all of it, and we trust you. Help our unbelief. Help us to trust you more. Help us to know that you are never against us, always for us. You're never apart from us. You're always with us. You know us thoroughly, and you're never surprised, and you're not saddened. You just keep coming at us with more grace and more mercy. Thanks for trusting us. Thank you for your Son, who keeps giving us grace, that gives us the life we so long for. Help us to give away what we've been given in generous amounts for your greater glory and our joy, we pray. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen. Folks, I was just informed that they're expecting us upstairs like ASAP for dinner.
Okay.
So now they have this little schedule on the door. And so let's go on up and have dinner. Thank you, Hud, so much.